Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next. Producers' picks of the week. Highlights of the best What's Next episodes heard during a select week. On today's show, we'll hear two segments from episodes that aired this week, starting with...
Just knowing that it exists provides some level of comfort and safety. Again, I think safety being the key word, that you can be yourself.
A conversation with Ron Piacesny and Sherry Fawcett from Niagara Pride. And we'll close with...
There's still an issue with a lack of representation in the post-production field, not just editing, but also music mixing and all kinds of different editing.
A sit-down with Dorothea Bramer, Robin Lazara, and Renato Graham from Buffalo State University's Post-Production Diversity Initiative. I'm Michael Loss. Thank you for tuning in. First, we revisit a conversation Jay Moran had with two familiar voices from Niagara Pride, President and co-founder Ron Piacesny and Programming Chair Sherry Fawcett. The three discussed some of the upcoming events Niagara Pride has on the horizon.
Niagara Pride is very busy. Busy June coming up, but it's been busy since the beginning of the year, you were telling me. Yes. What's fueling the activity?
So for us, one of the things that was important within our 50 year of existence was taking Niagara Pride from just being a organization that works within the community to now finally have a place within the community. Okay. And not just in terms of acceptance, which is always important. So I'm not talking figuratively, but this year we moved our offices and have a physical base of operation where we've been operating since April, holding programs and events so that people from Niagara County and even Erie County can now physically come to our offices and enjoy programming and services and events right in our new space.
Okay, that's in downtown Niagara Falls?
Downtown Niagara Falls, yep, 1522 Main Street.
Pinnacle Building.
Yep.
How's that working out?
It's amazing.
It's amazing.
Yeah?
I can't tell you how amazing it is. We have a conference room, a large conference room, a small conference room for presentations of things. Just this week we had Drag 101, which was, I did not think it was going to be very big.
Okay.
I ended up having to bring chairs in to fit people in the room.
Yeah.
Okay.
We've also had, what else have we had?
We've had legal clinics, presentations from UB Law have been there. We had a housewarming, office opening kind of ceremony.
Dignitaries
coming in. It's the office is alive and active and people coming in. And I'm going to say this, one of the things, we've always had our regulars that come to a lot of our events,
right,
or our social meetups that we do in the community. We are seeing faces and people we've never seen who are coming in because what I believe, and maybe Sherry, you've seen something a little different, you've had a chance to talk to them a little bit more, but I think it's a safe and welcoming environment,
yes,
that for the LGBTQ community, and I know myself, I feel welcome there. I feel safe to go to a space that's mine, that I can be my authentic self. I know that there's people there that will listen to me, whatever my issues are. Sherry is there serving as a volunteer staff member, since we don't have paid staff. But she is there 3 days a week. And then along with the programs and services that we've been offering and that we're going to be building on, coming up in the fall, as well as the summer, getting some ongoing services. I think it's just something that has absolutely been critical and needed in Niagara County.
Well, I would like to think that, like you said, new faces are showing up.
Yes.
It highlights the need for it, right? That,
yeah,
despite years and years, I'll call it progress, there's still that sense that some people are still reticent about coming forward.
Yes.
Exactly. And I think something that we have seen here in Buffalo, we've been very lucky in Buffalo in that we have had agencies that have a long history, 30 plus years of existence, let's say for like GLSS, Gay and Lesbian Youth Services, or the Pride Center. And so people in Buffalo have known about a space that they could go to and get help, or just pop in, say hi, or even if they didn't, just knowing that it exists provides some level of comfort and safety. Again, I think safety being the key word, that you can be yourself. And not having that in Niagara County, that folks from the most rural parts of Niagara County would have to come to Buffalo, created barriers.
Sure.
They couldn't get there. Some people didn't have transportation. A lot of the people that come to our office are coming by bus.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
So it's difficult.
Exactly.
And now where we are now in Niagara Falls, I'm finding out a little bit more. The bus station is right down the street from us, so they can get dropped off there on the bus and then walk up.
Exactly.
And it was I just found that out after our last event that we had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got to jump back just because you mentioned it and the different events that you've had at the new office. Drag 101. And you said it was... I mean, I think I know what it means by the title, but I'd like to just get into it just a little bit because, like you said, a lot of people showed up, a surprising amount of people showed up for this. So let's take a look at it from both sides. What was offered and also what you saw in terms of, I guess, the curiosity or interest of those attending.
Well, Drag 101 is kind of just teaching everybody the history of drag and what it means to the community and everything. And it was a little bit of makeup, a little bit of talk. And the people that attended were such a big variety. A lot of them have never done drag, so it was their first time. Some have done drag, but didn't really understand what it was all about. And so Freddie and Blue Darlin gave them all of that, and they also did their makeup from the start.
Wow.
Just the start. And then the finishing of their makeup. And it was just watching, sitting in that room and watching people's faces. And then afterwards coming up to me and thanking me for having that. And I said, oh, we're having another one.
Oh, really?
Yes, in June.
Okay.
In June.
June. You guys got a lot going on in June.
We have a lot going on in June, and that's not to overshadow all the other things that we're going to be doing as well in the fall with our LGBTQ youth drop-in center, senior drop-in center that we want to do as well. So we have a lot going on.
Yeah, well, let's definitely try to break through it, but it just kind of keep this conversation flowing because I think it's going real well so far. So so the new office is working out well. That's great news for sure. What about just a general, like, so it sounds like you're tapping into a need.
Yes.
In Niagara County and in that region as well. At the same time, you know, we hear different waves of attitudes boiling here and there around the country. We'll be like that. What are you seeing? Are you sensing anything? Different apprehensions from people? What are you hearing about?
So right now, I think one of the indicators and gauges that I think I use when I go and give presentations and talk to people and try to get that temperature of the community is I look at the ACLU and I look at some of the work that they're doing, and they track across the country how many different anti-LGBTQ pieces of legislation are put out every year. And that's state, federal, and local levels. Some of these pieces of legislation never pass, some do, but the sheer introduction of such laws really starts showing kind of what's happening in the country. Last year, we ended the year at 533 pieces of introduced legislation, and that can be anything from anti-trans bills, bathroom bills preventing trans individuals from accessing the bathroom, education where curriculum is modified to take out LGBTQ history, to equal housing, employment, you name it. It runs the gambit. And as of the end of April of 2025, so 5 months, not even five right. months, 4 months into the year, we were at 575 pieces of legislation.
Wow.
I would not be surprised. I hope this doesn't go that way, but I'm going to kind of put it out there. I would not be surprised if we hit 1,000 maybe this year anti-LGBTQ pieces of legislation around the country.
Let's hope you're wrong.
I hope I'm wrong too. I mean, that's a prediction I don't want to be right on, but we're looking at, we're not even halfway through the year.
I know.
And we have already hit last year's numbers and exceeded it by 50 already. And that's within the first 4 months. So to the question of what drives people maybe to come to our centers to seek out LGBTQ programs and services, you can't turn on the TV or the news without seeing something on the local level, a council member, a state legislator, a bill that's being introduced, something on the federal level. The LGBTQ community is constantly bombarded with anti-bills, legislations, you name it, rhetoric that is impacting our daily lives. And whether or not we live in a progressive state, fortunately here in New York, we are on the more liberal side. We are more progressive in terms of rights and legislation, which is phenomenal. However, our brothers and sisters around the country, depending on where they're living, are not so fortunate. And so we know that this is a daily concern that they are seeing. But I also want to just kind of point out that even if you do live in a progressive state, such as here in New York, when you, again, turn on the news, when you go to the internet and you see these news reports, even knowing that here in New York you're protected, you don't know as a teenager or as a kid where your life is going to take you. You may end up going to school out of state. You may find a job in another state. Are your rights going to be protected? Is marriage equality going to be upheld? There's already potential challenges that may make it to the Supreme Court, that may overturn Obergefell. We're seeing this, and the anxiety that is building within the community, you can feel it.
You can feel it.
You can touch it. You can hear it in the way people speak, in the presentations that we have had from UB Law that came to our offices. I don't want to say that they commandeered the presentation because that sounds negative. The presenters at some point stopped because there were just so many questions.
Right.
About, oh, am I even allowed as a trans person to get a passport? What happens if I try to leave the country right now?
Go to Canada.
I'm just curious. What were the? I mean, this might be for another program with maybe experts on this, but what was the answer about that? Because as you were mentioning that, I'm recalling both the president and the congressman or congressperson from Georgia, Marjorie Taylor Greene, in a recent reminding us there are only two genders, right? We hear that. I'm both interested in the legal element of it, but maybe the conversation that we're hearing as well.
So we are hearing that individuals who have changed their gender marker, even though they have all the other paperwork, some have been granted passports,
okay,
but it has been reverted back to the gender at birth, not their current gender,
okay,
identity. So that has been causing some confusion because, again, if depending on where you are in the transition process, you may not resemble what somebody may think of looks like a
right.
male, looks like a female, based on a piece of paper.
Mm.
And so even though there are right now, we are seeing that, okay, yes, some documents are getting processed. Some people are apprehensive about submitting documents for renewals and whatnot. But again, the confusion and the anxiety around, well, what happens when I try to come back to this country and let's say my document says one gender, but you look at me, I am not
male,
presenting female, that right now. What happens? And we haven't seen anything yet. I am not aware. I'm not saying that it hasn't happened.
Sure.
I just personally am not aware yet. But I'm sure that that's soon on the forefront. We will be seeing some of those. Yeah. Those issues.
Like you said, a lot of confusion, obviously a lot of apprehension. What else are people expressing about this type of issue?
Well,
just unknown. I mean, they're just, they don't know.
Yeah.
Because things are changing so fast, but not fast. You know what I mean? It's just, they don't know what to do.
Yeah.
They don't know who to go to. And there's nothing written in stone saying it's going to be this way or it's going to be that way.
Yeah. It's, I think like right now, like a great example, employment. Employment is something that people are fearful of.
Mm-hmm.
We know that Title VII has been expanded under the Bostock case to include sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression. So that was a couple years ago. So as far as we knew on the federal level, you were protected if you were LGBTQ and experiencing employment discrimination. Now, with the executive orders the way they are, if you are a federal employee, there are questions. How safe are you potentially in your position? And we also, I mean, we have seen the pulling back of diversity measures. But I think there's just right now, there is that level of concern with regards to those kinds of things. And it doesn't help when we look at historical context. Those of us that may remember in the community, whether gay, straight, LGBTQ, or ally. But if you lived through and remembered the McCarthy era, witch hunts, for lack of a better word, against the LGBTQ community. And right now there's been a pulling back from the Department of Justice, basically saying that if you are LGBTQ, that is no longer a protected class for the purposes of investigations. So you can't, after the McCarthy era, the government said, look, we will not go after people. We're not going to fire them. We're not going to investigate people just because you are openly out. And that has now, within the last couple of months, been revoked to say that, no, that is not an exemption anymore. So it reads as if the government wanted to investigate somebody just based on their sexual orientation, they could. I haven't heard anything that it has happened. But again, it is these, as Sherry just put it, these unknowns because of language being withdrawn and yanked from pieces of legislation, policy documents, that we don't know what the ramifications are going to be. And it's just leaving people in this constant state of wonder.
Right.
And what are my rights?
You don't want to test the waters either. You don't want to be that person that will have that happen to. So people are afraid to do anything.
Yeah.
I'm also wondering as well, especially for young people, hearing about this. And I know you could share probably your own personal experience, but just that time of your life where you're coming to terms with who you are. And I can only imagine what it's like for a teenager, an adolescent, who already is dealing with all the other things that an adolescent goes through, and all the wild, crazy things that go on inside you. What it might be like for some of these young people, and maybe the concerns that we have for them right now in this moment.
I'm gonna throw something out there because I love movies. I'm a big movie guy with quotes, and so the reference may be a little bit odd, but I think it'll answer that question, or at least try to answer the question you just posed. 2010, so the follow up to 2001, A Space Odyssey. There is a scene where Spoiler alert for anybody who has not seen the movie. It's like over 30 years now, so I don't think I'm giving anything away. It's
but
not
you
like
the youth have maybe not seen
that's
it.
Well, okay. That's
it might
true.
Might draw them to the movie. But
exactly, okay. Exactly. So it's not like The Crying Game where I'm giving some away or some secret here, or like the Titanic. It sank, people.
Oh, no,
it
you
sank.
Didn't. You just ruined it for people.
Go watch it anyway. But that being the case, so in 2010, at the very end of the movie, there's aliens, there's humans, there's all this stuff going on. But ultimately, there is a second star that is created in our solar system. And the narrator talks about how future generations, every child born on Earth at that point, will only know of an Earth with two stars in it, in the sky. And for those that were born after a certain point, I think Sherry and I are starting to, we meet younger LGBTQ people all the time. They have, for the most part, lived in a world where they don't remember the AIDS epidemic as severe.
Don't know about it.
They may know
just
about it.
The historical parts of it they know.
But not
the actual.
Living in fear because of things like PrEP and PEP and medications that have come about. They know of marriage equality. They know of all these things. They don't fear being terminated from their job because of being LGBTQ. Mm. They have lived in this world where, as far as they've known, these things have existed for them for their whole lifetime. So those of us that are older, I think, see it from the perspective, and at least I do when I look at stuff, is I studied it. I read about these things. I lived during that period. My formative years as a gay kid was during the height of the AIDS epidemic. I remember the prejudice, the discrimination that occurred. I never thought, I always hoped and wished that marriage equality would be a thing. I did not see it as being possible in my lifetime until certain things started to happen. And I'm like, wow, this could really happen. Like, I could actually be married.
And you are.
Exactly.
Congratulations.
So, thank you. It was a few years ago. But
hey, well, you know, belated.
Exactly.
Belated congratulations.
Exactly. So I think we look at it as we've seen a world where those of us that are older, it didn't exist. It was an incredibly difficult battle to win those rights. And we know how easily it can be taken away. And I think the younger generation, having seen or having grown up having those rights, doesn't have yet that personal experience of having it stripped from them. And I don't wish that for anybody.
Oh, I know.
Because it's horrific to have that happen.
To have it, then take it away.
Exactly. And I think that's, I don't want to say it's eye-opening, but it's very interesting to hear those perspective of young people because they're angry. I think they see what may be happening. They turn on the news. They talk to those that remember those times. I feel that there is a passion and a concern. But again, it's for those of us that have lived through those experiences, it's not a theoretical.
Right.
It's not that we're protesting or championing something that may or may not happen. We know what it was like when we didn't have that. We don't want to go back. And so that's my hope, is that in the sense that the younger generation never experiences that on a large scale federal level, and that maybe this is just a blip in history, and that the pendulum will swing back to a little bit more stability in terms of rights and equality for everyone. But I do love the passion that I do see in the younger generation fighting for equality right now.
And just to take that a step further, when we're talking about, you know, LGBTQ young people, they have the passion. Are they finding, as best you understand, you know, people with them that are straight that are with them in the same vein? I guess I'm looking as an older individual that there's some sort of hope for this younger generation to come, and perhaps, like you said, this could only maybe only be a small blip in history.
So, identifying as a gay man, I think this is maybe a question for Sherry. Not to put you on the spot.
Yeah, I mean, again, none of us are the young people, and I'm just cute.
Now I'm a young person.
You are the young person in the room.
I'm the old person.
In this room, you're the young person, right? Yeah.
But being somebody who's, I mean, you identify as an ally. You don't hide the fact that you're an ally.
No.
What drives you? Why are you with us?
Because I need to help. I have that passion. I'm a Black woman, first and foremost, and an ally. But as a Black person, I've always had the prejudice going on in my life. So I understand what they're going through. And if I didn't do anything, it would be wrong.
Mm.
Just, ooh.
Yeah. I think just as a side note, I was just speaking at a Holocaust event. And I think one of the messages that all Holocaust survivors and second and third generation, those of us that talk about it, I think our biggest thing is always about education and that need to be that person or that agent of change to ensure that it never happens to somebody else. Working with the Jewish population that I've worked with, working with Polish individuals that had experienced the Holocaust, again, being a second generation survivor of the Holocaust. My father was in a camp, and it doesn't matter, like you're saying, it doesn't matter if it's a Black African American individual. It doesn't matter if it's an Asian individual, if whatever the race, ethnicity, gender. We're all humans, and we never want to see that happen to anybody. So I think that's, we all have to work together.
We have to work together.
Looking at your website for June is unbelievable. And actually, it starts on May 31st. This is so encouraging to see this, the flag raisings that you're having around Niagara County.
Yes. So May 30th.
May 30th. Okay. Thank you.
I was thinking.
Oh, wait. Did you just add another event to our schedule?
I thought there was something else I forgot on my calendar.
Well, you have an open day. We'll find something for
it. Not surprised. Oh, man. So, no, May 30th. This is a tradition that we have been, 15 years.
Three for me.
Three for you, 15 for me, where we started doing a flag raising just in Niagara Falls. And over the years, the community has really rallied around the fact that the flag raising is an important, not only symbolic gesture, but it brings the community out. People come to watch, see it.
They take lunch breaks, whatever, and to be there. Mm-hmm. It's just incredible between the news and the public being there. It's just great.
Yeah.
So I mean, you're at Niagara Falls, but you're also, I think, I didn't write down all of the places, and you probably don't know all of that. But I think Lockport, right?
Yes.
We are in Lewiston. The day starts off in Lewiston, Niagara Falls State Park. Niagara Falls City Hall. Then we do a North Tonawanda Pride flag raising and a Lockport.
That's where we divide.
Yes.
And conquer.
Yes.
We do it together, and then it came.
Because of the times.
The timing. So we had to split, and I'll be at one, and he'll be at the other one.
Yeah. So it's safe to, I guess, assume then that you're being welcomed in by by town, municipal officials in these cases.
Yes. Yeah? And the state parks.
Yes, yes. I think there's a lot of agencies. Like Lewiston is actually at Art Park.
Okay.
So that's that creates a nice space for the community because it's a nonprofit. Art Park is a nonprofit. A lot of people go there. It's highly visible to show that. Again, not only is Art Park open and affirming, but so many people I think equate Lewiston with Art Park and the concerts and the events that happen there. So it serves a dual purpose in that it's also inviting people to Lewiston and shows that welcoming spirit there. Niagara Falls, that's been a 15-year tradition. So that has not changed. We have seen different administrations, and they have all been very welcoming. And even when COVID prevented us from being able to physically gather, the city itself found ways to promote Pride Month and do that. So we have been very blessed to work with them as great community partners. And then just the more recent ones with North Tonawanda and Lockport. Lockport, this is now its third year, if I remember correctly. And this will be the second year for North Tonawanda.
That was Ron Piacesny and Sherry Fawcett from Niagara Pride. We'll close out today's show by revisiting a conversation on Buffalo State University's Post-Production Diversity Initiative, which aims to increase representation in the post-production media field. We welcome Dorothea Bramer, an associate professor of media production at Buffalo State University, Robin Lazara, the program manager for the initiative, and Renato Graham, one of the program's 22 participants.
Overview. What is the Post-Production Diversity Initiative?
The Post-Production Diversity Initiative is a year-long program that is supposed to assist participants in entering the post-production field in entry-level positions. And it's designed to help people that traditionally have been barred, or barred is kind of a hard word, but didn't have
been impeded.
Easy access to to the post-production field. So there's still an issue with a lack of representation in the post-production field, not just editing, but also music mixing and all kinds of different editing. They're all are not representative of the society that we live in. And I do believe that to have a healthy media landscape, you need to have a healthy representation of the people that are actually living in that society. So when that grant came along, I was like, ooh, that sounds really cool. It was like a New York diversity, workforce diversity grant for specifically the film industry. And I called up the program officers there, and I said, would you consider something like post-production? And they were like, yeah, people don't normally apply for that. It's more like for people that want to be gaffers or something along those lines. But they said, yeah, but yes, we would definitely be interested. It took about at least 10 months to apply for this grant. Now we are the only initiative that has been funded by the New York State Workforce grant that focuses on post-production. And I think, Robin, you correct me if I'm wrong, but Shaylin, our program officer, also said we were the only one in Buffalo that got funded by them. I'm not sure. But anyways, we're the only one that is doing post-production. And our thinking was that we wanted to address three areas: mentorship, because mentorship is so invaluable and important in the field, more important than getting an A in your class or something like that. Mentorship, like somebody who's already in the field, and networking. The second element was networking, opportunities to network so that people can, enter the field through conversation and feeling more comfortable and understanding how the ecosystem works in the post-production world. And then the third one is skill-based. A lot of big companies such as Netflix require people who want to become editors to have a certificate in Avid Media Composer, which is an editing software, or Pro Tools, which is a sound mixing software. And you can get a user certificate, but if you want to get it on your own, it costs like $2,000.
Oh, okay.
So that's already, like, that's another barrier. So we thought, wouldn't it be cool to just kind of offer that certificate to participants? Of course, they have to pass the exam. We can't do that for them. But we are offering that class in both Pro Tools and Avid Media Composer. And then they can take the exam at no cost to them. So that's one of the benefits that we have for the Post-Production Diversity Institute. And the other one is one of the first people that I contacted was Munib Hassan, who works at the Motion Picture Editor Guild in New York. And I said, yeah, I mean, how would you feel about collaborating with us on this? And he was immediately like a very enthusiastic collaborator. Okay. And he was like, yeah, that would be great. You know, we'll have all these workshops. Well, I'll bring in, we have really great editors and sound mixers, and I can design a lecture series for you on Zoom. And then we'll also plan a trip to New York. You know, like we can go to these post-production houses. So he was the first person that I actually talked with when we designed this. And then I also talked to my colleagues, especially Meg Knowles, who's also working at Buffalo State. So it kind of grew out of those conversations.
You know, there's a couple of a lot of elements inside this. There's the diversity part, but again, back to the whole post-production element. Let's make sure that everybody understands what we're talking about here. Post-production when it comes to the film industry. What are we talking about?
Well, this program covers like video editing, and we had some classes about sound editing for film, like people who are interested in pursuing like dialogue editing for film and TV shows. But we also cover people who are interested in digital music production.
Okay.
So in addition to like film and TV editing, we also have some people who produce their own music. We just took a trip to Mammoth Recording Studio locally, and we got to see their space where they record local artists and then kind of mix everything in Pro Tools, the software that Dorothea mentioned that we're training our participants in. So it actually covers a pretty wide range. And a lot of our Motion Picture Editors Guild instructors showed their workflow in the different editing softwares. So our first instructor was an assistant editor, and he helps go through all the footage and organize it so that when it gets to the video editor for the film or TV show, it's all organized for them and they don't have to look for where specific things are. Our second instructor was like a picture editor, so she focused on mainly cutting the whole project together, whatever it may be. And then we had some sound editing, sound design, like I mentioned. And most recently, we had a music editor who edits music in Pro Tools for film and TV. But it was cool because people who are interested in music production could also benefit from seeing how he operates in that software.
22 participants in this initiative. 11 of them are Buffalo State students. I guess I have to give a shout out to Kadara Wright, who's one of the participants, well, a Buffalo State student, and has been a tremendously valuable intern here at Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR. But also 11 community members were selected for this. One of them is Renato Graham, who is with us. Renato, all right, so what drew you into this particular initiative?
That's a good question. Because I think I was the first person that applied.
You were. Renato was the first one, and he not only emailed us, he also emailed the people in New York. They sent me an email and said, there's somebody who's already applying for this.
So. Well, we should tell everybody, I mean, you're a media professional as it is. You've already been, right? You don't like that term?
I feel like I just got started today.
Okay.
But yeah, I guess you could say that. I'm going to use the word pioneer in
all
a
right.
sense.
Okay.
Because when you say diversity, and I guess the President of the United States clearly is making that a thing, but I worked on jobs that I was the only minority.
Okay.
And I didn't have any real formal training. When I say that is you can go to school, but you don't have any experience. And when you go on a job, you have to figure out how to fit around people that you don't know anything about their culture or them, if I can say that.
Sure.
It's like if I went to Japan, I was the only person that was American.
States, yep.
Let me just say that. And you don't know how to function. You don't know how to, and they don't know how to function with you. You know, because to be the only person of your kind, shall we say, on a job is brutal. You know, I remember when I got a job at Channel 4. They said, we don't normally hire people like you. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Whoa.
He said, production people.
Oh, okay.
So when you said, oh, that's what I thought. I'm like, wait a minute. The same thing happened to me when I applied at Channel 2. It was the same thing in a sense. But, you know, when I came in Channel 4, they took me down to the newsroom and showed me the computer and sent me to work. Then one day they just said, hey, you know, the guy didn't show up for the live truck. Run it.
Whoa.
And they gave me the keys, and it was kind of bootleg. You know, the switches weren't labeled or whatever. You know, whatever. So you had to figure it out. I like the program because the program is hands-on. They train you, and they take you on trips so that you can do field trips, and you can see what it is you're going to be working in. And then I don't think a lot of people understand it. Personality has a lot to do with it, too. I used to work for Channel 17 many years ago on Barton Street, and it was kind of the same thing in a sense. No real training in it, you know, and I had to figure it out when I went there. I did Monday Night Football, HBO Boxing, a lot of things, and it was like, same thing. One minority, two minorities, very few people of color. And you had to figure it out. And, you know, now I teach in the Buffalo Public School System, and it's a special program. It's I work with a group called Win Life, and we came in to teach life skills, and I started bringing some of my media equipment again. So it turned into a media program. And so we have about over $100,000 in media equipment in one of the public schools. You don't have to test into the school. So with my experience with the college, because I couldn't figure out what I was going to do with this program when they let me in.
Right.
And plus, I'm a little older. So I'm like, why did they pick me? Is one of my questions that I still have not answered yet. And I'm in
some
there.
Some questions are best not
answered. And the professor invited her to come to my class in the school, in the Buffalo Public School. Came in, exposed the kids to that. I want to try to tie the kids to the college so that they can have relationships and they would go to high school and eventually end up at college in this program. Because they, in eighth grade, some of my students don't even know what they want to do in life, period. Sure. So I think their program is important. People come in there and they're like, you got full podcasting. They're flying drones to fourth graders and commercial level drones. And they're like, why are you letting them touch your equipment? And because I didn't have no insurance at that time on them. And I like because I started when I was at Langston Hughes Institute when I was 13. And they exposed me to it. If they didn't expose me to it, what would I be doing now? I don't know. So the college, the program, I think my tie is a tie to Buffalo Public School kids have a relationship with the college. The college came to us, and hopefully we can go to the college. And that's something I don't think the school thought about. But I realized me being part of this, I don't know if I'm going to work for Netflix at my age at this particular point now. Maybe I will, maybe I won't.
But yeah,
I don't know.
You know, but since you brought up your age, what about the training on Avid and also Pro Tools? Are you finding it relatively easy? I mean, you know, they say older people.
I always wanted to do that.
Okay.
Avid and Pro Tools is extremely technical to me.
Okay.
You know, and to a lot of people to use the equipment. But that's the standard. You have to learn it.
Sure.
So I always wanted to learn it. I never really I dabbed in it, whatever. I never did it. But I think this is the opportunity for me to learn that and master that skill. And even if I don't do it, I can teach my students.
Okay.
So I think that's good.
Talk about the diversity of the program, though, right? So I said 22, 11 students, 11 yeah. community members.
So I think age diversity is super important, and we all felt that is an important factor. Also, it's kind of ironic that in some ways we glorify our youth in our society, but the people that have more stories to tell are older people, so why not give access to them also to the media equipment? And Renato is not the oldest in our program. I think it brings it adds depth to the experience, and makes it more community centered. I think. I don't know what you think about this, Robin, but so that's one level of diversity. But I love the fact that Renato is going back to the Buffalo Public School and kind of creating a little ecosystem of knowledge. I mean, I think shared knowledge is power. You know, like you share your knowledge and you spread it around. Another really great point that you brought up is the access to the equipment. There's a lot of film programs that require you to make a short film to get admitted. Well, that means that you must have you know, Adobe Premiere somewhere in your house or something already before you even apply to the film program. I think that's not fair. I think people that don't have access to editing equipment should also have access to a media education. And Buffalo State has a very strong record of being very inclusive, I think. And I think that's why this program is very well suited to be in Buffalo State.
We're talking about the Post-Production Diversity Initiative at Buffalo State University. Dorothea Brayman with us, also Robin Lazara and Renato Graham. I want to just kind of circle back a little bit to the discussion, and you touched on it, everybody's kind of touched on it a little bit, and I'll open it up here, but the idea of why it is important to have a more diverse workforce in media production. And in terms of storytelling, like you said, you know, if you're older, you've got more stories to tell. I find that not everybody wants to listen to my story. But that being stated, but how about for you? You know, Robin, you know, getting in, you obviously are, you know, you got your own initiatives besides this as well. What about that idea that what are you seeing maybe developing, maybe not only among the initiative students, but some of your colleagues as well, and comparing it to what has been the media stereotypes, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, I think representation is super important, not only in front of the camera, like the characters that you see on screen. I feel like the people working behind the camera being represented is just as important, because like Renato teaches younger people, they want to look at and see people that look like them working in the field and doing what they want to pursue doing. And everybody has different stories to tell. So even though editing can be a super technical job, it really could come down to just storytelling. Mm-hmm. Because you could be working for like a newsroom, or you could be working on a narrative project where you're telling a story. And I just think it makes... This is going to sound so corny, but that's I feel fine. Like it makes the world a better place.
I like that.
When everybody is represented, and everybody has a say in decisions that are being made, and it's not just the same people doing the same thing over and over again and shutting people out. I've worked a bit in the film industry, more on set than like editing on big projects. And I would look around and always see like the same people. So it's really important to me to help people who are aspiring to get into film, to connect them with people who are already doing it, to learn about, oh, like if you were just starting out, what do you wish you could have done differently? Like asking experienced people these questions, and just kind of learning from them to help them get to where they want to be.
Any other thoughts about that? Especially the thought about, you know, having different people involved in the process. I mean, you know, Renato, you were sharing your experience earlier about what it was like showing up at some of these job sites to do this work, and you're the only minority on set.
Yeah, it hasn't got a little better. I followed the mayor around, Mayor Brown, for 4 years, doing media for him, and a lot of places we went, I was the only minority, me and him. And I explained to people something really important. You know, when there was critical on Byron, I was hired on him too, until I realized in the history of Buffalo that was established, I don't know, in the 1700s, 1800s, whatever, he's the first minority man of color ever in the history of the world to be a mayor here in Buffalo. And when I say it like that, people are like, wow. And, you know, we was running around. It was like me and him, the only sometime in at places. And I don't think people realize that. And the qualifications of me working, a lot of times, who can I learn from?
Right.
You know, I don't see anybody like me, and I'm the only one on the job, so I guess I was a pioneer in the thing. So when I talk to the students, I try to prepare them that you can't walk around with your hands in your pocket. You can't wait for somebody else to tell you how to do something. You're going to have to figure it out. And a lot of these kids can't figure it out. Their attention spans are so short now that... But one thing shocking to me at the school system was some kids was walking by the classroom. I started last year, and they were walking by, and I'm new to the school system. And they're really young. They're like fourth graders or something. And they popped in, was curious of what was going into my room because they seen the equipment. They came in and I said, they can stay. They're not bothering me. We went outside and flew the drone the first day and they knew what they were doing. And we assumed they weren't capable. The older they get, it's difficult. But the younger, they do whatever you ask. And they're amazing. And they're teaching me stuff on the iPad and all kind of stuff. I'm assuming, wait a minute, your little kid, don't touch that. And I'm like, wait a minute. Now I'm calling them over and talking about, how do you do this? So we need to start preparing them now before the world messed them up. And I'm not trying to get into politics, but that's fine. When I watch the news, they're talking about cutting all of our funding. In public broadcasting and whatever. Like, I did work at Channel 17, so I did benefit from it. I worked at the first public access in Buffalo, so I did benefit from all of this. But, so that's important. I'm just plugged. Fun arts in the program.
Yeah. I think access to the arts is so important and being inclusive. Another example that I thought of is music mixing, like mixing audio. And we are also collaborating with digital music with Tomas Henriquez, the professor there, just to mention that. But even in our program, all the people that were doing music mixing were, you know, white guys. And it's a very, very gendered profession.
Okay.
But you actually, Morgan Koziel is working here, right?
Yep.
She's part of the program also. And to break that gender barrier with music mixing is extremely important, I think. And not just sound mixing, I mean,
right.
Not just music. So that's another example where we just need a more diversity. Every study shows that a more diverse environment creates better outcomes. School, if a school is diverse, the learning outcomes go up. And I think that's true for every environment. You need to have an inclusive environment because shared knowledge is more knowledge, you know.
Another thing that you mentioned, I think before we went on the air, Renato was somewhat touched upon it, the idea that, okay, you can get an A in a class, right? And you can get all the good grades you want, but there is that extra, that little something that is needed if you're going to advance in this field.
Yeah, I mean, I love what Renato was saying about you don't really, like, if you're the only one in a situation, it's like it's very hard to figure out how do I fit in, and to just kind of figure out how do I fit into this ecosystem of post-production, and how do I behave. We talked about getting into the film industry, it's also a personality issue. I would say it's an attitude issue. Like, you have to have the attitude of being curious, of being able to present yourself in a positive light also, without nonstop boasting or something like that, but you have to present yourself. I think that's another thing that you have to learn, especially if you've been taught a lot that you're supposed to be humble and quiet, you know, or something like along those lines. I mean, that's why we have these portfolio classes with Atina Ferret Cook, who's part of the initiative, and she really honed in on the lesson that it's okay to talk about yourself and define yourself before other people define you. That's another issue that a lot of minorities have. It's like others are filling in for you because they're so used to doing that. So you define yourself and you present yourself to society in a way that facilitates engagement and dialogue. And those are all skills that are, like, they're not only important for post-production, obviously they're life skills.
Right.
And I'm hoping that, you know, people are learning skills that will help them navigate the environment regardless of what they're going to be doing later on.
We're winding down to our couple minutes here of talking about the Post-Production Diversity Initiative. And I know this is year one. We don't know if there's going to be a year two, but we're already looking, hoping,
yeah,
keeping our fingers crossed and doing all the grant work to see if we can get another year.
Yeah, we're really hoping that we're able to do this again. After actually doing it for a year, we obviously learned a lot, and there's a lot that we would improve going forward. But when we initially opened applications last year, we had over 50 people apply. So that helps show that there's a need for this. And we were initially planning on only accepting 18 participants, but since so many people applied, we increased it to 22 because we were like...
And it's worked out. 22's been okay?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. It's been really great. So fingers crossed.
And we already have a lot of people that are interested to apply for the second year. So there is interest, there's need for that kind of education, I think.
And how about this for a final question? I'll pose each of you to go this through. What for you, how does this program, how can it be judged a success? What do you think, Renato?
A lot of people I talk to, they're like, I didn't hear about that. How come I, you know, so they want to be part of it because it's exciting to them. And all my students, they're all excited. But a lot of people, when I tell them about the program, they want to be part of it. But there's not enough cheers. But if there's one improvement I can say for the program.
There we go.
I couldn't get into the building because I wasn't a student.
All
the outsiders are like, who are you? Where's your
ID?
You
got access, but not building access. Yeah.
Okay. I did. So it's working on that.
And that's something we talked about for next year, partnering with some local organizations.
Because the police didn't know what to do with me. You're not a student. Where's your ID?
So he can only get in when the program is running. And there's bureaucratic obstacles.
Sure. But back to success. For you, what is it? How do you judge success in this program?
Well, there's a requirement from New York State that we have to track everyone for like 5 years.
Oh, wow.
and see what they're gonna do. So that there's that kind of measurable sort of success. Like, what are these people gonna do? And I'm kind of curious. I want to stay in touch just to see, you know, what are you gonna do with this? Another success for me is how much community are we creating through this program? How much fellowship are we creating? And, you know, I've seen bonds made between Buffalo State students and community members already kind of in a way that I think is meaningful. So that is also success. And just to see Robin in action has been, you know, it's really great. So success to me is, you know, like that the people will stay engaged and in a meaningful way. That to me is would be success.
And Robin, how about for you? Success for this program? How does it look for you?
Yeah, honestly, I feel like after we have like a Zoom session with the Motion Picture Editors Guild or like one of our creative portfolio classes, and I hear some of the participants talk about how they learned a lot and they really enjoyed it and like they really liked the instructor, or like Dorothea was talking about how a lot of people are introverted and like nervous to talk about themselves and what they do, even if they're super passionate about it. I watched them throughout the course of these creative portfolio classes gain confidence in themselves, and like they're all working towards creating a website to share their work. So I feel like I celebrate those small successes after every class where people took something away, because that's like watching them grow and learn in real time. And it's really cool that this program offers all of these opportunities free of charge.
And that will do it for this edition of Producers Picks of the Week. We thank our guests, Ron Piacesny, Sherry Fawcett, Dorothea Bramer, Robin Lazara, and Renato Graham. If you missed anything, or just want to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts, including the full individual episodes aired in today's compilation. Each episode is online at btpm.org. I'm Michael Loss. Thank you for listening. Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.